We're the Nonprofits. I'm your metaphorical host, Dennis Lube, along with Matt Dillahunty.
Hello.
And Kathleen O'Connor.
Hello.
Along with a special guest. And we're coming to you live, in a spiritual sense, from the Dillahunty International Studios on the 10th of October, 2009. The music was a traditional piece called Listen to Reason by Brian Stieksma. This show is said to be sponsored by the Atheist Community of Austin. Of course, this could mean any nonprofit educational organization for the promotion of positive atheism and the separation of church and state. To learn more, let the voicemail at 512-371-2911 guide you, or visit the website at www.atheist-community.org. Many think the ACA hosts a happy hour at the Dog and Duck on Thursday evenings at 7, but the word happy can be translated to mean merely anything non-miserable. Although many believe the nonprofits literally broadcasts live every other Saturday from 2 to 3:30, modern non-prophologians dispute this interpretation. Most do agree, however, that one can participate in the show by following the directions found at www.nonprofitsradio.com and joining the chat room. Although there is some dispute as to how much one should enjoy the show, or even the precise meaning of enjoy, you are nevertheless encouraged to sit back during it.
Oh, that was the end.
That was it.
I'm sorry, I got distracted by the chat stuff. I don't want to waste any more time because I already told folks that we'd have a guest on. So joining us live once again seems to be one of the more regular guests that we get to call in, even though it's been months. PZ Myers, welcome back.
Hello there. Glad to be here.
So one of the reasons I'd spoken to you before you headed out to California, you went to the Atheist Alliance International Conference, and there was a big brouhaha about Bill Myers being the recipient. But I thought it'd be good to maybe have you tell us a little bit about what went on at the conference relating to that and other things.
Well, it was a well-deserved stink, I think. The problem was that the person they nominated for the Richard Dawkins Award for promoting good science was Bill Maher, who has done some good things, and he has done some very bad things. And the bad things tend to inflame people quite a bit, and rightly so, I think. In particular, his promotion of bad medicine, alternative medicine, vaccination, hysteria, all this kind of nonsense.
Yeah, and I found it kind of curious. One of the things that we talked about in recent shows, I wrote actually a rant about Bill Maher back at the end of July when AAI announced who was going to be getting the award, and I wrote it for the blog shortly after ORAC and others did. And then we kind of waited to see what would happen. But in the meantime, what we ended up talking about on our show a couple of times is something that I marked or labeled the skeptic schism. As somebody who's also active in the skeptic community, I went to the Amazing Meeting 7, my first amazing meeting. The subjects come up that in the skeptic community, the atheist, which to me is the natural result of being a skeptic, seem to get kind of sidelined, or we'd rather not discuss religion at these events. And even the MC at TAM, Hal Bidlack, had pretty much kind of hinted, we'd prefer you respect people's beliefs and stay away from religion a little bit. And I saw some posts from people in the skeptic community, some people had just simply saying that you could be both skeptical and theist, something that I dispute, or at least that you're appropriately applying it. But we'd had big discussions about this, and I'd received lots of email. Also, the flip side, of course, is that just because you're an atheist does not mean you're rationally minded. That doesn't mean that you're a skeptic, and I think Bill Maher's a prime example of that. And so this kind of fed into the whole discussion. And when I watched Richard Dawkins' introduction, somebody had recorded it, where he announced the presentation of the award, and it was nice that he mentioned that we don't necessarily agree on all things, and certainly he went and pointed out explicitly that he doesn't agree with Bill Maher on medicine issues. I was kind of still bothered when he says, you know, I'm proud to have my name associated with Bill Maher. It's maybe I'm just picking nits, but it seems like it would be more, I'm proud to have my name associated with what Bill Maher has done with regard to religious.
Yeah, and this is going to be a problem that's going to grow and grow and grow, because we're hoping atheism will grow, right? And that means we're going to be associated more and more with people who are, well, marginal. That, you know, we can't be too pure. So this is going to come up all the time. What we need to do is keep doing, like you were doing and like Orac was doing, is just because somebody is, you know, nominally one of us, doesn't mean we let up. that
right.
We have to keep pounding on everyone. It makes our community an interesting group where we're all busy beating up on each other, but hopefully we're all acquiring these nice thick skins so we can handle it.
Yeah, we're all looking for the perfect spokesman.
And there isn't one.
Yeah.
And in particular, what's happening here is, you know, you see it in TAM, and you also see it now in the RDF, is that we're reaching out to fairly popular figures in the media. I mean, TAM has been doing this for years. And what you're going to find is there's a whole bunch of compromises, that these are not people who have gotten to their position because they have rationally thought out an intellectual stance. It's because they're good on TV or in movies or something. And that means they're going to be bringing a lot of irrelevant baggage.
Yeah, I think, you know, you talk about us kind of beating up on each other a lot. We've done that. I completely agree. I'm kind of optimistic, though, because I think the things that we tend to beat up, you know, we're not in a position where we necessarily eat our own, but we're actually raising the level of debate and having discussions about things. And there's kind of an honesty to saying, you know, as Dawkins did, you know, while I appreciate Bill Maher's efforts with regard to religious, he's a nut when it comes to, you know, medical issues.
Yes.
We see that a lot, and, you know, we have this discussion about what went on at TAM in the skeptic community, what went on at TAM and in the skeptic community. It's a great big world. Obviously, it's going to take all types, even within our small group here in Austin. You've got, you know, various personalities that may conflict. You have some people who are of a different political strain than you, or have a different view on an issue, even some conspiracy theorists. So we're in this position where the skeptic community isn't, and this is me putting my judgments on it, the skeptic community by and large isn't perfect, and the atheist community also isn't perfect. And those of us who are perfect would like to change that.
But you were referring to me there, of course.
Of course, I included you right off the bat.
Well, yeah, and I agree that what we want to do with both skeptic and atheist communities is we want to have an open admission policy. We want to welcome everybody, because we want more and more people in these. But at the same time, we have to make it clear that the price of admission is that we will flay you alive if you say something stupid.
Yeah.
So get used to it.
Ooh, I like that.
The one of the comments that Bill Maher made in Religious, I watched again last night. Dawkins actually quoted this in the introduction speech, and I'll just paraphrase it, was that religious moderates need to realize that the comfort that they get from religion comes at a terrible price.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's... It's one of the reasons why I do what I do, and why I've called religious moderates and even religious liberals, you know, part of the problem. Yeah, by and large, you're nice people who just have some belief that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, is utterly irrational. And you're not doing harm with it, but you're enabling and protecting the people who are. I'm wondering if we're not in danger of doing the same thing by... acknowledging someone like Bill Maher with such a prestigious award, in that, yes, he did something, you know, that was by and large good, that a lot of atheists, non-theists enjoyed, but the extra baggage that comes along with him, I'm wondering if the price isn't too high.
Yes, and you know, I talked to several people who are on the AAI committee, and I talked to Richard Dawkins himself, and one of the things that's come out of this argument is an awareness that we have to be more alert to this sort of thing, that we've got to be more careful. That for instance, if you look on the AAI site, there's a couple of definitions of this award, and one of them is for, you know, general promotion of good critical thinking in science and all this kind of stuff. And Bill Maher does not qualify. that he's got some specific points that he makes that are very good. But in general, no, he's a disaster. And I think what we have to do is, you know, take some more care, sharpen up the language of what we're doing, make it clear that, you know, because we're going to be giving these awards to people in the future who are also going to have skeletons in their closet. We got to make it really crystal clear that, no, this is not an overall endorsement of everything this guy says. And that should be the case for all of the people who speak for skepticism and atheism. Now, you know, Richard Dawkins himself, go ahead, rip into him, criticize him. That's a good thing. That's what we want to encourage.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, the fans of this show have appreciated it, is that there are three or four voices at any given time, although mine tends to be the loudest and most frequent. and we often have disagreements. We had a three-hour debate on the show about free will. We've had discussions back and forth about, you know, circumcision and other issues like that. And we're all still friends. And so in some cases, we all still agree or disagree on some issues. I, you know, challenge things that you've said. I challenge things that Dawkins said. I go after Harris on occasion. But I still greatly respect and appreciate all those guys and could hang out with them, probably have conversations with all of them. It's this idea, when you're having discussions with a theist, a religious individual who's particularly devout in the obstinance, everything you say challenges what they believe is personal to them, because it's core to who they are. And while that may be the case for some beliefs that I have, I don't take them personally. If somebody's challenging me on an issue, they're talking about my position on issue, I don't know how best to encourage people to just say, you know what, I don't, she's so beholden to my idea because it's mine.
Yes. Well, and this is also a general characteristic of this skeptic community, is we like good argument. This is fun, sitting down over a beer and not slapping each other back. Caring to each other is just great entertainment. That's always the case. I also think that this is one of the things where Bill Maher kind of failed. You know, he took no questions at the award ceremony. Okay, I guess that's what they do at these award ceremonies. But also, Richard Dawkins actually posed to discuss alternative medicine on the Bill Maher show, and he refused. He didn't want to do that.
Oh, interesting.
So
you know. That's probably a greater failing of Maher, that he's closing his mind and he's refused to acknowledge that people disagree with him. And in putting this stuff out on the air and hashing it out, I think a show with Bill Maher and somebody maybe with a little credential in the medical community than Richard Dawkins, where they just fight over alternative medicine, would be really interesting. I'd like to see that.
Yeah,
I hope he does it someday.
It would certainly be more interesting than what we tend to see, which is, you know, credulity pranced around with no criticism on all kinds of, you know, we had a guy call into the Atheist Experience TV show a few weeks ago who wanted to talk about near-death experiences, and during the course of the discussion he starts throwing out percentages, you know, 83% or 90%, and he admitted that he was just making these percentages up, and it was so entirely frustrating. It was like, okay, well, if you can do it, can I do it? Can I just, you know, spew nonsense back at you, and then we're at this stalemate. And he was, you know, obviously what he was really expressing was the sincerity of his conviction and not any actual data. But we see the same type of thing without necessarily numbers from Bill Maher and Jenny McCarthy and others who...
We just have to start using numbers. You know, 100% of dead people stay dead.
Well, yeah, until you start getting into fine points about people being resuscitated, were they actually dead or not. But yeah,
eventually they'll be dead, right?
I'm with you there. The one of the issues that I took exception to is that in the description for the AI award, and I don't want to spend the whole day talking about this, it specifically said that it was to honor an outstanding atheist.
Yes.
And I don't know if Bill's position has changed. There are a number of comments from him. One of them I put in the blog post. I mean, the direct quote from him, this was from 2002, though, was, "I'm not an atheist. There's a real big difference between an atheist and someone who doesn't believe in religion. Religion to me is a bureaucracy between man and God that I don't need, but I'm not an atheist, no.
Yeah.
I believe there's some force, if you want to call it God. I don't believe God." So, I mean, I can understand somebody not being too sure about what they believe and not being particularly comfortable with the atheist label.
Yeah, and then when he introduced Richard on his show the other night, you know, he says, "My fellow atheist."
Yeah.
So he's sending mixed messages, and I think what it is that Bill Maher doesn't think very much. to give him credit for, you know, thinking through his position, I think is giving him far too much credit.
Yeah, there were people who were saying that, you know, their primary view of Bill was that he was more enamored with taking the unpopular stance than with expressing a position that he thought through critically.
He's a contrarian, and he's an anti-authoritarian.
Yeah.
That's the defining characteristic of Bill Maher, not skeptical thinking.
So enough about Bill Maher, obviously, and let me do quick introductions. Kathleen is here. Dennis is here. Russell's out sick. We're really glad you came down. I was kind of hoping you could be our unofficial roving reporter at AAI to tell us what went on there that didn't involve Bill Maher, for those who didn't get to go.
Oh, me? I'm the official reporter?
Why not? I'd have you call every week if I could, but...
Let's see. What happened that wasn't discussed? Oh, the Atheist Nexus had a really good party.
Awesome. Cool.
So, yeah, that's what you all missed is Saturday night, they really pulled out all the stops. They had a good band, a very loud band, and it was kind of amusing. It drove away all the old gray-haired fuddy-duddies, except for me. I hung out anyway. And all the young people were left behind dancing away and having a great time. And I'm kind of hoping that they'll encourage this sort of thing, that's what we need in the atheist community is more encouragement of the young blood to get out there and have a good time. So yeah. I saw a lot of it. It was very nice to see.
One of the areas where we've had a continual kind of problem is definitely in the younger community. Our group sponsored a campus group at University of Texas Austin. Of course, students graduate and.
Uh-huh.
They go elsewhere, and they don't always leave somebody in their place, or they don't always find somebody who's as committed to running the group as they were, so the group falls by the wayside, and then every 2 or 3 years you end up starting back over. I know the Secular Student Coalition has done a good job of helping to foster and encourage these groups. I definitely like to see more, but the only thing the ACA has really done is to have a happy hour that's close enough to campus that those students are willing to walk over and have a drink. I'd love to find, you know, in our group, I've tried to focus on the word community in it, to build the group to be whatever the group wants it to be or needs it to be. We don't need to imitate anybody else. We don't necessarily need to be activists on specific issues. If people just want to get together and have a good time and socialize and talk where they're not feeling like they'd better keep their mouth shut and sit in a corner and nod and smile because they're surrounded by people who believe things that they consider to be absurd, then that's enough. On the other hand, we're here next to a campus with 50,000 students. We're in the capital of a state that is in serious disrepair with a critical State Board of Education that after tossing Don McElroy out on his butt, although he's still on the state board, he's not running it, and getting past evolution. Then they go after history standards, and next year we're going to be electing a new school board, and the first thing that they're going to have to address is health.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this is, you know, I'm looking for new ways to encourage people to get involved. I'm not necessarily expecting you to give me a solution, although if you have solutions, we'll certainly consider them.
Well, I don't have solutions. I mean, the problem you're describing here is this one of institutional memory, that you need to have traditions, you need to have, you know, rules and bylaws and all this kind of stuff, and you also have to have mechanisms for maintaining the continuity from year to year. And most atheist groups are kind of ad hoc, aren't they? They just sort of, you get some motivated students and say, hey, let's do this. Let's bring in a speaker. Let's mm-hmm. let's all do this year. And then the next year they graduate and it falls apart. What we're seeing, though, is we're seeing more and more of these organizations that are coming together to do this sort of thing. You know, the SSA, for instance, is a really good group that's starting to pull it together. The Center for Inquiry, with any luck, you know, getting affiliated with those will provide that institutional memory and will improve the continuity from year to year.
Yeah, what I've noticed, I traveled around to a couple of campuses last year and probably a couple more this year, but the religious groups, they don't fade out like this, and it's because they are sponsored and run by a church, by and large, that is not affiliated with
right.
the university other than yep. through the students. So it seems to me we need to foster a sense of community that keeps the group alive as the students, you know, progress through it. So
yes, yeah, they have things like Campus Crusade for Christ too, which has, you know, a national organization that can pour money into these local groups and do right. all kinds of interesting things there.
Yeah, money seems to be the recurring theme where we run into a problem.
Yes, and then also, you know, one of the problem we have is, you know, I don't know if you go to many atheist groups. I do. And some of them are painful to attend. That they're really a bunch of old people who sit around and grouse about religion, which is not interesting if you're 25 years old.
Yeah,
you've got better things to do with your life. And so, the external institutions, you know, things like your local atheist group, often don't have anything in place to appeal to younger people, and so they're not there to provide the kind of input that would lead a campus group into doing something interesting. And that's something else that's got to change. We've just got to be thinking more positively and more socially about things that will entertain everybody of every age group and people who aren't necessarily walking around with a chip on their shoulder about religion.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, one of the other things that I was going to ask you about while we have you on the phone, we've had conversations about this before where obviously none of us can be experts on everything. We simply don't have the time, and so we must rely on authorities in areas that we're unfamiliar with. Sometimes we do this to our detriment. I mean, if you're not as knowledgeable about medicine as somebody and you rely on the wrong person, you could
yeah.
end up dead. But since I'm not an expert on biology or evolutionary biology, I wonder if you'd chime in on Arty.
Oh, sure. Isn't it cool?
Yes, saw the pictures.
Yeah. You know, what it is, it's part of normal science, that we keep on digging up this new data and keep digging further and further back. So Ardipithecus ramidus is this beautiful specimen from it's multiple specimens, actually. It's been pieced together from 4.4 million years ago. And basically what it does is it pushes back our understanding of the human lineage another million years. And we can see what preceded the Australopithecines, like Lucy. And she's very interesting because, well, she's much more human-like than people expected. Mm-hmm. You know, people were thinking, well, the predecessor was probably something a little closer to a chimpanzee, you know, a little less bipedal. What we find in Ardipithecus is that she's got a lot of features that are very human-like, you know, the structure of the body and so forth. But at the same time, she's got some quirks, like her feet, for instance, you know, that she's got that opposable big toe.
Right,
right.
Rather striking. She wasn't quite as, you know, quite as good at bipedal locomotion as we are. And they could speculate. These are reasonable speculations, of course. These are inferences from the actual data, so it's not like just guesswork. You know, they could speculate about her lifestyle, that she was probably living in a wooded environment and was clambering around on trees and also walking on the ground, so kind of a mixed behavior there. But that was what was interesting. So we get this little snapshot of what the hominin lineage was like over 4 million years ago.
Cool. But of course, the creationists are having a field day.
Oh, well, no, they're
well,
not.
We created
two
more gaps.
They're frantically making excuses.
yeah. She's created a gap. Two more gaps.
The funniest thing is this character David Menton out of the Answers in Genesis. I just wrote something about him yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's horrified. You know, well, he's disgusted and appalled and all these other things because she's just an ape.
Oh,
which,
boy.
Which you've got to say, well, of course, we're just apes, too. What did you expect?
I think they're a crocoduck.
Yeah. Right, well, my opponent said, what did you expect, a giraffe? I mean, if we found a giraffe in the human lineage, that would be really surprising. it wouldn't be evidence for evolution, of course, but it seems like that's what they want. They want it both ways, that they want something that's not what we expect, that's not ape-like, but that wouldn't fit.
It's another example of them abusing science, both the intellectual integrity of science, the open system of acknowledging what we do and don't understand yet, and also the thing that's so frustrating to me is that they twist what would be a reasonable expectation. You know, like you mentioned, this is an example that surprised us in some ways.
Yes.
And so they'll use those surprises as evidence or assert it as evidence against what it's actually supporting.
Well, they also assert it as like, you know, see, they were wrong.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they were wrong in what they thought. And now here, they're changing it again. Look, you just can't trust them. It's so frustrating.
Yes. Yeah, that this is what we should be expecting from our science, is that every time we push it back, we will find something very surprising, something unexpected, because otherwise, why do science?
Yes, we already know the answer.
The other thing that really bugged me about it is in these creationists are all saying, well, she's just an ape. She's merely another fossil. And this is such an anti-intellectual position to take. I mean, even if I grant them, you know, if I imagine myself, you know, somebody takes a ball peen hammer to my head, so I've got severe brain damage, and I imagine, okay, the world was created, God made it all this kind of stuff. Still, finding a new species, you know, a radically new species like this, ought to be grounds for excitement. Even if you're religious, you should be saying, well, hey, wow, isn't this a wonderful example of God's creative powers? But instead, what you find is that they're all belittling it, which is just...
What I find bizarre is that to prove evolution to a creationist, you have to show them something that would disprove evolution.
Uh-huh.
You know, you have to show them the crocoduck, which would disprove evolution. It's like the only way you can prove it to us is to disprove it. You know, it makes no sense.
Well, exactly. This is a common problem when dealing with creationists. Is they're sitting there and they're pontificating on how evolution is all wrong, but you sit down and you talk to them, you discover they don't understand evolution at all. They've just got this mishmash of misconceptions in their head, and they sit there railing against this nonsense that isn't in the biology books, that doesn't make sense, that doesn't fit into our understanding of evolutionary theory, and they think by doing so that they've made a comment against biology.
And those wrong ideas have to have been deliberately put in their heads, because evolution... The core concept of evolution is not that difficult to understand.
Right.
You
right,
have to be deliberately misled.
Well, they acknowledge microevolution, though.
Yeah.
Oh, but that's only a rhetorical ploy, so that they can say, well, I'm open-minded and scientific. I can accept this teeny tiny little piece of it. And then they go on and dismiss all the rest. But macroevolution has been demonstrated just as strongly as microevolution. If anything, macroevolution was the first piece of evidence for evolutionary biology. Darwin had no idea about this micro-macro distinction.
Right.
And all the phenomena he described were macro-evolutionary phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, Dennis, Kathleen, did you have something else?
Well, it just kind of made me think a little bit about a YouTube video that I'd seen recently with Richard Dawkins interviewing a creationist. I don't know if you've seen that. There's like 7 parts. I only got through the first part. And basically, it's a woman. I don't remember her name. Have you guys heard of it?
Oh, I've seen.
Oh, yes.
Part of that.
Right. It
couldn't
was
stomach it.
Yeah, I only got through the first part, but it just, you know, watching him try to argue with her and her saying to him, "Show me the evidence. Show me the bones. Show me the evidence of transitional fossils." And how do you combat that, or is it even worth trying, I guess, is my question.
Oh, it's worth trying, of course, but there's nothing that's going to get through to them. I mean, if you're saying, you know, if they're saying there are no transitional fossils while you're laying out the bones on the table in front of them, you've got to recognize they're pretty obtuse. They're not going to pay attention to anything you
exactly.
say.
Right.
All of these arguments have to be made for the people who are listening in. For the, you know, for those of us who are internet people, we do it for the lurkers.
Yeah, it's, when we take live calls on the Atheist Experience, it's pretty much the same thing. If I get into a heated debate with somebody, I don't have any illusions at all about changing their mind. It's it's for somebody else who's going to stumble across the clip or watch the show, and we get email from those people. I got emails this week. I'm not going to read them because they're things that kind of embarrass me in the praise category. But there are people who have benefited from conversations that when I was finished with them, I was like, boy, I don't ever want to do that again. That was so painful. Hopefully, you know, that's enough. And I end up having those conversations over and over anyway.
Oh, yeah, I get this all the time. I regularly get email from people saying, yeah, you made me think. I changed my mind. I'm going back to school and studying biology, or I'm an atheist now, whatever these sort of things are. And you're right, it's not the kind of thing you can put on the blog or in the podcast because it's kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
We're naturally modest people, of course. it's much more entertaining to put the crazy ranting kooks up. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I've gotten to where I appreciate the various different styles that I've seen from people. You know, I'll absorb some of it. I watched Religious again last night just so it'd be fresh in my head. And Bill, when he's interviewing people, he alternates between being pretty patient and just asking questions and letting them make themselves look foolish.
That's right. He gives them rope.
And actively making fun of them. And I've done some of that. I prefer, you know, on the show, we tend to do more deeper delving into let's analyze this, you know, construct a syllogism if you can. And then I watch, you know, Dawkins have conversations with people who he's got way more patience than I could ever have.
Oh,
right.
It's like the policemen
on
cops. I mean,
I like the idea that if you let this person talk, they will say something that is so silly that everybody out there would see it and say, oh my gosh, look how silly that guy is. The problem is, I'm not convinced that there's enough people who are recognizing, because I can picture family members. You know, if I watched Religious and this individual said something and I about fell out of my chair laughing, I can picture family members who are religious just nodding and saying, yeah, she's right.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was actually just having a conversation with a colleague earlier this morning about Dawkins and O'Reilly. You know, he was on O'Reilly the other day.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I saw that.
Right. And he was making the point, you know what, O'Reilly's audience, his natural audience, is sitting there watching this, and they're thinking Bill O'Reilly cleaned the floor with Dawkins.
Yeah.
And I agreed, this is probably true. But then Bill O'Reilly's natural audience is a collection of morons, so who cares? But
well,
then he wondered, why appear on these shows at all? Because Bill O'Reilly's audience is not our people.
Yeah, it's not. It may be very unlikely that you're going to reach a good segment of the audience. That's one of the reasons why I've had, you know, people have been trying to get me in debates, particularly with Ray Comfort, who's like I've defined as my arch nemesis, mostly because it would be the
Ray
easiest.
Ray Comfort is your arch nemesis?
Well,
boy,
it would be
the bar low.
Yes. I did that so that it would be the easiest possible debate to begin with. But the thing is, when you're talking about this audience, we had a debate which was we defined as a debacle at UT between Michael Shermer and the Reasons to Believe guys, who are day age creationists.
Oh, right. Yes.
I don't know if they're running around doing this as a tour together all over the place. I think, you know, I had some strong criticisms of Michael Shermer and in a number of areas. But in that particular scenario, you were at a university with thousands of people. You definitely had people from both camps there, which means I think that there was a good chance that there may have been some undecideds in the audience or some people who could have been swayed. And yet, if you talked to either camp, of course, as you would in any debate,
right. They won.
Their side won.
Right.
You know, and nothing, we all know, nothing's going to be resolved by debate. I mean, not, you know, even science, when people are having debates and considering evidence, it's not the debate that resolves it. It is the evidence that supports the debate that ultimately, you know, proves true. But as futile as it seems, I have to keep supporting that. I have to keep wanting to do it. I have to keep wanting to see more of it because as futile as it seems like it may be the best course of action in some cases at some times. So
yes, I mean, the alternative is just to go silent.
Yeah, and I
and
think
they're
that's,
not going to. They're going to keep battling right. away. They've got, you know, they've got the AM radio airwaves and other venues like that. And so we have to keep on pushing. And if nothing else, it's giving us good practice, which I think is useful, because there will be occasions when you talk to these same sorts of people in situations that are perhaps a little more accommodating. And the other thing is that, for instance, the Dawkins-O'Reilly debate, while the other side is saying they won, our side is saying we won. And I think that's useful. That's community building, that we can show this video of Dawkins and O'Reilly arguing, and we can reinforce the values that we like in our community, which was that Dawkins, for instance, was very calm and having a good time with this and, you know, responding rationally. And what is O'Reilly doing? His usual thing of shouting fascist.
Yeah.
Well, he did.
It's helpful for us.
Dawkins did call O'Reilly on the fact that he was just yelling at him and wouldn't let him talk, so I thought that was good as well.
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder.
And again, that's modeling the kind of behavior I think we have to encourage in our community, is being fearless, getting up there and talking to these people, but at the same time, call them on this kind of nonsense they're pulling in. He did a good job of that.
Yeah, but it's like they've never been introduced to shame. So calling.
Well, that's one of my big concerns too. Is that, you know, the theist Christians in particular will flaunt their supposed moral high ground like crazy and question how atheists can be moral or ethical at all. And yet, from my perspective, not only are we the ones who are more properly ethical, but that this is actually hindering us, because I don't take, for example, a clip of something stupid that O'Reilly or Ray Comfort or anybody else says and march it out to the ACA at the, you know, weekly meeting and say, look what's going on. I need more of your money so I can fight this. And yet that's what they do. And, for example, Obama got the Nobel Peace Prize. By the way, I don't think he deserved it.
But
I don't know who else who they could have given
Perhaps
it to.
Perhaps the bar's been set low due to recent events.
It seemed to me to be more of, hey, we want you to know that we're happier with your country now than we used to be.
Yes.
Here's a cookie.
He won the Nobel on the rebound.
But the thing is, and you might have pointed this out at your blog. I read so many that I get confused where it came from, but you're a primary source for half of what I say, I'm sure. Before I even found out or heard a news report or saw it at the White House blog, groups like, I think it might have been Focus on the Family, were already putting this together to add fuel to the Obama's a socialist who wants to take away God and guns and we need your money.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. If those Norwegians and Swedes are favoring him, there's obviously a problem with the man, right?
Right.
It must be.
Yeah, he's not only black, he's somehow related to those godless Scandinavians.
Just has a very deep tan.
All we need. See, I'm wondering if the big concern is when you get people like David Icke involved. You know, if for example the Christian contingent kind of drifts off into obscurity one of these days, is it the reptilian conspiracy?
Oh boy,
I love
that's
that going
to gain ground. It seems like that would be a lot easier to debunk.
But
I've seen the videos on YouTube. I don't know.
Well, in one of the, I don't remember if it was in Religious Proper or in one of the outtakes. I believe it was one of the outtakes, maybe.
No, I think it was in the actual movie when they mentioned it.
Well, he did talk to David Icke. We've talked about that before. Yeah. What's the state of the world when, how do you reach a population that is by and large good? I mean, I have, for example, the majority of my family. Are religious Christians, fine people. They don't. I have people in my family who will say the Bible is the literal word of God and everything in it is true. And if you attempt to point out how absurd this is by saying, well, do you then believe this? Well, no. But they've always got a rationalization for why that, you know.
Right.
It's like, okay, that part's not true, but the whole thing is still true. One of these days, somebody is hopefully going to figure out a way to break through that compartmentalization. It's not going to be me.
I don't know what it
because
is.
Because I keep shaking my head. I'm not even sure how I broke free. I mean, you know, 25, 30 years and then starting to be a minister. I don't remember what the trigger was. It could have been, you know, a song I heard. Maybe it was, I think it was the accumulation of questions and what would have been at the time subversive content, you know.
Yes, it's like trying to cure cancer. There's not going to be a magic bullet. There's going to be a whole bunch of things you have to do that will eventually resolve it. And religion is the same way. I've just compared religion to cancer. Good for me. Anyway, yeah, it's the same sort of thing. It's a complex phenomena. It's got all kinds of sources and causes and results. And looking for simple answers just won't work.
Yeah,
right. You have to attack it from multiple directions, which is good since you've got 8 tentacles.
Yeah, 10 actually.
And you're not the first to compare religion to cancer because Dennis did that once upon a time when somebody asked him, if you get rid of religion, what do you replace it with?
And I go, once you're cured, you're done. Yeah. I mean,
once you eliminate the cancer, what do you replace it with?
Nothing.
Nothing.
You're healthy.
So,
I actually have a question for you guys, for everybody.
Ooh.
I was wondering what you all thought about this latest development with Ray Comfort and Kirk Cameron and celebrating the anniversary of Origin of Species by adding the 50-page intro to books they're going to be handing out. Because when I heard about this, I feel like I just went through all these different emotional stages of anger and then denial and just all of them. And I'm wondering if anger, you know, it's not... It's the visceral response, but it almost seems as if they are wanting us to take that role so that it props them up more as the martyrs, that they are being persecuted and they are being censored. And I'm just wondering how you guys feel about that and how we should deal with that.
Well, first of all, I don't think there's anything new. This has been a problem since the 1960s when they first came up with this whole idea of scientific creationism. This has been their strategy for over 50 years now of stealing the facade of science and putting up in front of their Bible and pretending that they're doing real science. So this is just a natural outgrowth of that what Comfort and Cameron are doing is they're stealing the good name and the integrity of science to hawk lies. And
so should we just ignore it? Should we...
Oh, no,
just
no,
turn
no,
our
no.
backs
don't ignore
to it.
it. No. We've been ignoring scientific creationism for so long, and look what it just got worse and worse. You know, it grew. So this is the kind of thing where we need to fight back.
Yeah, calm them on.
I think what we need to do, though, is you know, I don't think the appropriate response is for a bunch of atheists to descend on one of these groups handing out their fake books and publicly pissing on it, mm-hmm. or setting it on fire or anything
like
that.
Right, I agree.
Yeah, that what we want to do is we want to respond with a little bit humor and a little bit in kind. And the kinds of things I think we ought to be doing is encouraging these campuses who are being invaded by these nutcases is, hey, yeah, accept these books. Why don't you get a couple of professors together and offer a little public demonstration of the quality of the book, you know, pull out these books and tell everybody, hey, turn to page so-and-so. Let's all read along and see what kind of way Darwin was thinking. Let's turn this into an opportunity
yeah.
to promote the good part.
To educate.
One of the movements or reactions that has been proposed is for students to grab as many copies as they can, rip out the foreword, and then donate those to libraries or else. Not only do I already have a copy before they took it down from the website, the foreword.
Yeah, I have one.
I want a copy of the book with the foreword in it. I want it forever on my shelf. I'm going to highlight it. I'm going to use it as examples. And I think it would be, I think PZ's idea is outstanding in that you could, at any of these campuses where students have got the book, announce an event where you're going to discuss the foreword specifically and have real scientists comment on the objections and comments that are in the forward.
I think that's a great idea.
That would be great.
You know, rather than just...
That would be entertaining.
It should be good fun. Going back to...
I also told everyone to do the same thing. I told them, don't destroy these books because they're probably pretty flimsily built anyway. And so if you rip out the foreword, it's probably going to fall to pieces.
Yeah.
But, I want some... they're not coming to my university. So I said, somebody ought to send me some of these because I've got a whole shelf full of these creationist books that I collect. And... I want this added. I'll put it right up there next to Harun Yahya's big book about evolution.
I've got a place reserved for it next to Ray's book. He autographed a copy and sent it for free of the You Can Lead an Atheist to Evidence, but You Can't Make Him Think. So I'm going to be next to that. Going back to something you said a minute or so ago about how it's not the right move to ignore this. My story, which I touched on briefly, I was a Christian for 25 years or so and was starting to be a minister when I finally broke free. But there were people and ideas that I'd never heard of and never been exposed to. One of my great idols, I suppose, is Robert Greene Ingersoll.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a name you'd hear. Hell, I didn't hear Thomas Paine. When I was in school, I didn't know who the hell Thomas Paine was. So that'll tell you quite a bit about my upbringing. But I realize that looking back with the nostalgic eyes is not always wise. But it seems like we've lost ground because of silence. Once upon a time, you had a free thought movement that was active. You had people like Ingersoll who were giving public lectures and speeches. I believe he did the Republican Party convention one year as the speaker. And this is a public figure. People were of the impression that religion was on the downcline, that this was for perhaps the lower order of society. And so, we've won. And this got twisted into there's two things you don't talk about in good company, and that's religion and politics, and helped encourage this idea of silent acquiescence to I'm just okay, you've got some nutty idea and you're entitled to it, so I'm not going to say anything or challenge it. And that ignores the harm that necessarily comes. I mean, your beliefs inform your actions, and we're now facing the consequences of decades of silence.
Right. Well, it was silence because, the people who were promoting batshit insane politics and religion didn't shut up. They kept yammering away and allowed themselves to become held up as the standard of political and religious discourse. And that's kind of where it went away. But I think that's changing now. I'm surprised at how in demand I am to come talk about atheism and science and things like that. But I think that's happening all over, is people want to hear more of the calm, rational, scientific side of the debate. So there's a little backlash going on, which I think we got to keep going. I hope we can keep more and more people jumping into this discussion and keep the discussion going in the direction we want it to go.
Absolutely. And on that note, I'd also like to let you know that as soon as I can, we'd like to get you to come down to Austin. We do a lecture series once a month plus special events, and it'd be great to have you down and show you the one kind of lifeboat of reason, the blue speck in this insane red state. But,
I have been to Dallas and Houston and Fort Worth, and everyone tells me that Austin is the place in Texas to go, and nobody ever invites me down there.
Definitely.
So.
Yes, it is the Mecca, if you'll pardon the expression.
I will repair that lack of an invite as quickly as I possibly can. We've got probably a little over a half hour left in the show. I don't know, Dennis, did you bring in mail and stuff to go through?
Some, but not much.
Okay, I'll give you the option, PZ, of either hanging out and continuing to comment, or we can handle our mail stuff without
you. I'm happy to hang out, yeah.
Great.
Awesome.
All right, well, while you're looking at our mail, I'll let the folks in the chat room know that if you have a specific question for PZ, you can PM it to me, and if it's not sucky, I'll ask it, although I'm sure I've asked plenty of sucky ones. I do have a special request as well for our listeners. And, being the guy who runs the show, I get to do stuff like this. My girlfriend is going to be speaking at her university with regard to healthcare from a non-theistic perspective. Basically, there are a bunch of nurses in training, and they get people from different religions to come in to talk about, what to expect when you're dealing with those patients. And she was looking to see if anybody had examples of proselytizing that happened to them while in the hospital or, a doctor's office, etc. So she can give examples of the type of things that perhaps non-theists might appreciate and educate these nurses on how to be a little more aware of all the range of beliefs or non-belief.
Right. Well, there was a good piece of news. I mean, if the Shroud of Turin accidentally gets burned up, we can make a new one.
Yes.
Guy discovered how to do it. Awesome.
I don't think I heard that.
There was a news story this week.
Yeah.
You had, Dennis.
Rome, an Italian scientist says he has reproduced the Shroud of Turin, a feat that he says proves definitively that the linen some Christians revere as Jesus Christ's burial cloth is a medieval fake. The shroud, measuring 14 feet 4 inches by 3 feet 7 inches, bears the image eerily reversed like a photographic negative of a crucified man some believers say is Christ. We have shown it possible to reproduce something which has the same characteristics as the shroud. Luigi, I'm going to mangle this name, Garlicelli, who is due to illustrate the results at a conference on the paranormal this weekend in northern Italy. Well, I guess a conference on paranormal can occasionally come up with something worthwhile. a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Pavia, Garcelli, made available to Reuters the paper he will deliver and the accompanying comparative photographs. They placed a linen sheet flat over a volunteer and then rubbed it with a pigment containing traces of acid. A mask was used for the face. The pigment was then artificially aged by heating the cloth in an oven and washing it, a process which removed from the surface but left fuzzy a half-tone image similar to that on the shroud. He believes the pigment on the original shroud had faded naturally over the centuries. They had then added blood stains, burn holes, scorches, and water stains to achieve the final effect. So, cool.
So they're trying to remake a zombie movie from the original Jewish zombie.
That's right. I guess you can make a Shroud of Turin in your basement.
I think we can improve on it now. I think what we ought to do is get Richard Dawkins to volunteer for the treatment.
Cool.
And make a bunch of shrouds of Dawkins. That'd
be great. Sell.
Well, while I would love that and laugh my ass off, it does raise a concern that's been going around about the reverence for Dawkins as some kind of atheist pope. And while I absolutely adore the guy, we had a good but quick conversation when he was in Austin, and I'll brag till the day I die that he ran to get his iPhone so he could take a picture of my tattoo. But I have the campaign A tattooed on my upper arm, so that was fun. But you know, there is this concern. I think it may be a false concern by and large, because most of the atheists, at least that I interact with, are all independent thinkers. And if Dawkins came out and said something that was just crazy, they'd say, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Shut up.
It's one thing to have somebody that you admire who speaks somewhat on behalf of you, perhaps better than you could yourself. And it's something entirely different to be walking lockstep behind some, you know, authoritarian figure.
Yeah, I think what's useful, though, too, is things like making a shroud of Dawkins would be simple mockery of the whole principle of the idea that nobody would take this seriously and there would be nobody worshiping the shroud, while the Catholics, of course, are worshiping their own shroud, which is the point we try to be trying to make, I hope.
Yeah, and you and I, though, are fans of mockery while some others aren't. I get I'm ostracized quite a bit from some people who wish I was a little bit more conciliatory towards the religious people. For example, while the whole host desecration thing was going on and you were defiling yours, I was snacking on them with queso on the TV show. So.
Well, at the AAI convention, I did have a little snack of communion wafers with Richard Dawkins, so he's joined in now, too.
Ooh. Was that for Blasphemy Day?
It just so happened it was Blasphemy Day. Yeah, I guess it was.
Perfect.
So, as somebody who's originally from Missouri, I have news about Missouri.
Uh-oh.
I'm embarrassed to say that Claire McCaskill is the state senator, or one of the state senators from Missouri. And somebody, a fan of the show, a friend of theirs, sent an email to their state representative about gay marriage. And this was the response that he received from Claire McCaskill. "Thank you for contacting me regarding same-sex marriage. I appreciate hearing from you, and I welcome the chance to respond." Boy, does this sound like a form letter. "I support efforts to grant legal recognition of same-sex couples' civil unions. Current federal law denies same-sex couples the same rights, privileges, and benefits that are granted to heterosexual couples. This unique treatment is a discriminatory policy, and it goes against our country's sacred principles that all Americans deserve equal rights under the law." At this point, I was like, cool.
Yeah.
You know, she's not my favorite person, but I kind of like her. Then it continues, "While I believe that same-sex couples should be recognized in the eyes of our government, I will not support legislation to legalize same-sex marriage. Our nation's founding fathers had the remarkable sensibility and foresight to protect religious freedom. And as your senator and a practicing Christian, I will remain committed to uphold every American's right to freely practice and express their faith as they so choose. Our government has no business forcing a religious faith to conduct or recognize any marriage." It seems to me that She did what so many other people have done, which is spun this into, if the government allows same-sex marriage, that is the equivalent of forcing churches to violate their own beliefs and perform the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what this is about at all. And it seems to me that this should be an easy meme to correct.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, she's probably a decent person who just has her beliefs and wants to be as nice as she can to homosexuals within the bounds of her beliefs. But she, as a senator, is in the position where she's convinced that if we legalize same-sex marriage, her church, which is against it, will have to perform the ceremonies. And that's just not true.
Yeah, right. Sounds like she's misunderstanding or doesn't have knowledge on the subject.
Well, you know, if Obama gets his way, the old people will have to be killed, right? You know, it's that same kind of just boneheaded, idiotic principle.
We have to kill all the elderly to make room for all the new gay people.
What the heck?
Well, we can turn them into crackers, too. That'll help some of the hunger problems, right?
Do you think it would help McCloskey if we mentioned that most of the gay people I know are atheists and they wouldn't want to go to our church anyway?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also kind of socialist. So, you know, this is a debate about something that doesn't happen.
Right.
Well, it does happen, but not very often.
Well, I find it kind of ironic that she's talking about the protection of religious freedom for everybody mm-hmm. and the protection of rights for everybody. And yet she doesn't recognize that there are denominations that identify themselves as Christian that have no problem at all with homosexuality mm-hmm. and would and have performed these marriage ceremonies. And so what she's really doing is saying that her particular brand of Christianity is the right one and the one that matters and the one that we should legislate based on.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What is her brand, by the way? Is she Baptist?
I don't know, but I'd put money on it, being mm-hmm. from Missouri.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, that whole paragraph, almost like it directly contradicted itself, you know. Guarantee religious rights, except you can't get married. You know, what the heck?
Yeah.
Wait a minute.
So there's an article about from the Vatican. I can't really put it any better, so I'll just read it, even though I know how much people hate that. The Vatican has lashed out at criticism over its handling of pedophilia crisis by saying that the Catholic Church was, quote, busy cleaning its own house, and that the problems with clerical sex abuse in other churches were as big, if not bigger.
Define cleaning your own house.
That means you move all the dirt from one house to another. But, you know, their excuse is, okay, yeah, we had some problems with this, but that church over there has got a bigger problem than we do.
Oh, God.
There's, you know, one of the principles that, you know, once I abandoned my religious strictures, I had to go through and reevaluate everything I believed and why. What are my views on, you know, abortion, homosexuality, even things that I don't even consider to be moral questions at all anymore? I had to reassess them. And, you know, there's perhaps no simple answer on how one forms a moral code, but one of the simple principles that I came to realize real quick was that, hey, you know what? I'm responsible for what I do and what mm-hmm. I say. That means that I get to take pride in my accomplishments, and I get to own up to my mistakes. This is something that is absent in religion, many religions,
yeah.
but Christianity in particular, with this idea of atonement. And it's so prevalent that it's infused the organizational structure with, well, you know, okay, we might have had some mistake, but look over there.
Right.
You know,
right.
If I was the Pope, if they made me Pope tomorrow, I would actually clean house. And I would say, you know, our church has done things that are wrong, and we're fixing it now, and we're making, you know, amends, and we are no longer going to hide criminals from prosecution, which is what they've been doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to that whole thing of I'm just too ethical to be religious.
Yep.
I cannot do the types
you
of religious cons that go on. I couldn't do the Peter Popoff, I'm going to heal you all thing. Anybody that wants, there's a guy that they had in religious, this Jose Miranda
sure.
Jesus, who
thinks he's Jesus,
claims to
yeah.
be,
right.
You know, I'm not convinced he really believes it when you listen to him talk.
Oh, yeah.
But he's convinced thousands of other people that this is true. Happens all the time. In new, you know, you've got Mormonism, Scientology.
Sure.
I don't think I was ever that unethical. And I don't know. I just have to stand by the conviction that even though we might be able to benefit and change the world through unethical behavior, that it's not worth it. That the
right.
ends don't justify the
mm-mm.
means.
Well, it's the same with Sylvia Brown and John Edwards and those people who claim to speak to loved ones that have died. And
mm-hmm.
I mean,
yep.
Now, the other question I have about that story is did they ever get specific and say what other religions are worse than the Catholic Church on these matters? Because I haven't seen it.
They mentioned, let me scan down the article real quick, because I know that they referred to Protestants, but I don't know that they specifically pointed to any other church or organization. But I've seen studies where by independent organizations that show that, you know, the prevalence for pedophilia is as high, if not higher, in some Protestant churches than it is in, you know, than in Catholic churches. But I don't know how reliable that is.
Because it always seemed to me that the heart of the problem here is that the Catholic Church enforces a perversion called celibacy on its priests.
Right. Right.
Which is going to naturally erupt into all kinds of problems, or it's going to be selecting for people with pathological ideas about sex. So, you know, I'd be surprised if other churches have problems of the same sort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you allow your priest to get married, that probably clears up a whole bunch of the problems right there.
Yeah. There are more, well, it's hard. I was going to say there are more offensive things in this comment from the Vatican, but it's all so offensive that I really can't say it's more offensive. So in this statement, the Holy See said the majority of Catholic clergy who committed such acts were not pedophiles, but homosexuals attracted to sex with adolescent males. So,
wow. Oh, yeah, it makes it okay if they've got pubic hair.
Yeah, or, you know, this blaming it on, you know, homosexuals again as a kind of a hand waving. The statement read by Archbishop Silvano Tomasi, the Vatican's permanent observer to the UN, defended its record by claiming that available research showed that only 1.5 to 5% of the Catholic clergy were involved in child sex abuse. Only.
Wow.
Only as many as 5%.
How many priests do they have? How many clergy?
A lot.
Yeah, well, what they didn't mention there, so it's 1 in 20, but how many of the other priests are aiding and abetting by keeping silent about it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another contributing factor.
And, of course, that's their number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're going to lowball it.
He also quoted statistics from the Christian Scientist Monitor newspaper to show that most U.S. churches being hit by child sex abuse allegations were Protestant. So they've narrowed it down to the U.S., in order to make it not look so bad. Meanwhile, in Ireland, there's been a huge outcry with regard to pedophilia. Of all priests involved in the abuses, 80 to 90% belong to this sexually oriented minority, which is sexually engaged with adolescent boys between the ages of 11 to 17. This whole thing is just, we're going to try and soften the issue, we've done what we can, and now we're going to point fingers at, you know, oh, well, we let some gays in and we didn't know about
homosexual.
It. As if being gay means you're necessarily attracted to younger people or more attracted. As the Catholic Church has been busy cleaning its own house, it would be good if other institutions and authorities where the major part of abuses are reported could do the same and inform the media about it.
Uh-huh.
Wow. You know, in much the same way that the Vatican City doesn't represent, you know, what I used to think Christianity was or what it was about, they don't seem to know what's in their own Bible either, where there's the instruction to remove the plank from your own eye before pointing out your neighbor's. And I just find this so unbelievably funny.
Yeah, well,
and sad.
They're all amazingly unself-aware. It's like,
and before blaming homosexuality, I would think the Catholic Church ought to think about the institutionalized misogyny of the Church that teaches people that women are inferior, that they're dirty, that they're unclean, that they're sinful. This may be more of a factor in why they're seeing reports of more meddling with young boys, and also the availability of the various individuals that they work with. You know, I grew up in the Lutheran Church, and I had no problems with pedophilia or anything like that. But the pastor is mainly working with the young boys, not so much the young girls.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's like Boy Scouts and Cub Scouts. You know, it's there's this segregation of the sexes that goes on throughout, and that's probably more of a factor in why they're seeing more reports of priests meddling with young adolescent boys
and
anything else.
And in a potentially related, but this is not anything religious, this is about social structure. Society is gradually changing, and the perception that we have about women and girls and social and gender roles, et cetera, is gradually shifting. But we've grown up in a culture where girls were to be protected and boys were to be tough. And so I would think that by and large, people would not think twice about leaving their young boy with a minister, whereas some parents would think twice about leaving a young daughter with a minister, even though he's, you know, a man of God who's supposed to be above reproach.
Right.
You might think twice about that, because you think nothing about, you know, leaving your son with him.
Yes.
And this sort of, you know, it's going to skew any data. It doesn't, but it doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to me what the data are or what percentage of priests molest kids and how many of them molest boys more than girls, or whether they're Catholic or Protestant. The fact is that there's a huge problem here, and the solution by the organization responsible has been to thwart the authorities' ability to investigate and to hide criminals from punishment.
Yeah, and that makes the organization criminal.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
Besides, didn't we all learn when we were like 4 or 5 years old that saying that your brother did it doesn't make you any better, any less guilty of doing something naughty?
Yeah. That's right.
They haven't mastered that little lesson.
No.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we can expect that. I don't know if we can really expect that when they worship a being who, by most accounts, is a child, a jealous, vindictive, temper tantrum throwing. Little infant with no sense of justice
or proportion.
They would claim that he is the perfect justice. No, if you read through the Bible, there's nothing in there that represents even a justice that I would say is good, let alone is perfect.
Yeah,
right. Well, and then the whole heart of the Christian religion is this whole idea that you can achieve redemption by proxy. Somebody else can take your sins for you.
What the hell?
Which is pretty bad too.
What's up with that?
Yeah, let's find a scapegoat, then we're okay. Yeah.
Quick note for the listeners, Richard Dawkins is going to be in Charlotte at the Dana Auditorium in Queen's University of Charlotte at 7 p.m. on October 14th, if you'd like to attend. And by the way, PZ, if you've got any scheduled events, you're free to toss them out.
Oh, I would have to look at my calendar, but I'm taking a month off to get some writing done. But then, yeah, I've got a whole bunch of things planned, and you just have to watch my blog. I'll list them there.
I've been trying to figure out where you find the extra, I guess it must be like 72 hours per day, that you obviously have some way of eking more hours out of each day than everyone else. I don't know how you do it.
You know, I'm a biologist. We have this thing called cloning.
Ah. Oh,
there's a couple of me running. You never know.
There's I get sidetracked real easy, but
facility.
there was an episode of Family Guy. It's an older one. I'm watching repeats that I saw the other night, and he has a stroke.
And Peter does?
Yeah, Peter has a stroke, and he's walking around with his entire left side limp and everything else. And he walks over, and there's this stem cell research facility, and he walks in, and he comes back out feeling great. And he asks the guy at the door, how long was I in there? He goes, about 5 minutes. And he goes, this is amazing. How come we're not funding this?
A little exaggeration there. Yeah.
Well, it's better than the exaggeration that South Park did on stem cells, where they had, what's his name? Superman died.
Chris Reeve.
Right. Yes, just running around plucking the skulls off babies and sucking the juice out of it.
it's like they thought he was an atheist or something.
Didn't see that one.
All right, well, we're getting... Keep going, Dennis. You've got more.
Oh, boy. Let's see. There's the Scalia thing, right?
Oh, yeah. I've got an article on that one.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
And I'll just
you
stay
wanna
quiet.
You want to read this one?
Not really.
Oh, okay. let's see. A little exchange between, I guess, ACLU representative.
Oh, those and, evil and, atheists.
And Justice Scalia. And Scalia saying, like, the cross doesn't honor non-Christians who fought in the war.
And the ACLU representative responds, "A cross is the predominant symbol of Christianity, and it signifies that Jesus is the Son of God and died to redeem mankind for our sins," replied Ellisberg, whose father and grandfather are both Jewish war veterans. "It's erected as a war memorial," replies Scalia. "I assume it is erected in honor of all the war dead. The cross is the most common symbol of the resting place of the dead." "The cross is the most common symbol of the resting place of Christians. I have been in Jewish cemeteries. There is never a cross on a tombstone of a Jew." "I don't think you can leap to that, to the conclusion that the only war dead the cross honors are the Christian war dead. I think that's an outrageous conclusion."
Yeah. This is the same Supreme Court justice who had no idea that there were multiple versions of the Ten Commandments.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When it came time for him to review the case about Ten Commandments monuments. Basically, he just turned the religious symbol into a secular symbol by fiat.
Right. Mm-hmm. Which no one will claim is a secular symbol.
Yeah, this is
in any other venue.
This is the symbol that is specific to their religion that some people of other religions might be a little irritated to find out that they or their relatives have been buried with this over the top of them. And he basically said, well, I don't see how you can say that because we put it up there with the intent of honoring everybody.
Right.
Okay, I don't care what you think the intent was behind this. We're launching an objection. You know, somebody had suggested that when Scalia dies, bury him with, you know, a satanic symbol or something over his grave. Mm-hmm. Which I
suggested an Islamic
crescent. Yeah.
I don't know. You know, when you do something like, I can't even talk about it. I had this one of the very first shows that I did 4 or 5 years ago was about the Ten Commandments cases. There were two at the same time. There was the one in Texas, which is still there, and there was one in Kentucky. They ruled against the one in Kentucky, and they ruled for the one in Texas. And in this case, the justice that I was pissed off at was Breyer, because he invented out of whole cloth a grandfather clause and basically said that the Texas monument had been there for so long without anybody complaining that it could stay. I mean, there was no element of the case that factored into this. It was he got to be the swing vote, and on one vote, oh, look, they put up the one in Kentucky and people complained, so I'm saying you got to take that one down. And on the Texas one, he said, oh, that one's been there, you know, and nobody's complained. So if we learned nothing else from that case, it's to complain.
Uh-huh.
Complain right from the get-go, the minute you know, file your complaint so that at least it'll show up. But in both of those cases, Scalia was, you know, on the side that I disagree with, obviously, and seemed to have no understanding of the subtleties of this. He's in a position where he has his beliefs, and his beliefs so color his opinions, and he has no interest in attempting to objectively assess the case. Ignore who brought the case, the ACLU.
Yeah.
You know, what if it was a Jewish guy who just said, you know, hey,
right,
I'd prefer that we didn't put Christian markers up to celebrate all of our war veterans who represent a diverse segment of the religious population.
Let me just play devil's advocate for a moment. Okay. What if they proposed, and this is completely hypothetical, but what if they proposed, okay, well, we'll put up a cross, we'll put up a crescent with a star, we'll put up all different, you know, bunch of different symbols for that represent all the different religions.
Then
all of them? That would be interesting.
Yeah.
It would be pretty
crowded.
It looked like a junkyard, but
yeah.
Hey.
That was one of the things that came up. One of the three prongs of the Lemon Test is whether it's part of a larger secular I'm not getting the right word here, display.
Mm-hmm.
And Scalia and others argued that the Ten Commandments monument here in Texas was part of a larger secular display because on the grounds there are a number of other statues and things. When I do get you down to Austin, PZ will definitely run by the Capitol so you can see that. Because there's nothing near it, and there's certainly no larger secular display. But mm-hmm. with that being the test, and granted, with me not being a lawyer, you're still talking about basically a plurality of religious imagery that doesn't necessarily constitute a larger secular display.
Mm-hmm.
On the friezes for the Supreme Court building, where you have various homages to different lawgivers, where you have, you know, Moses is up there along with a bunch of others that aren't necessarily religious. So I have no objection, because it's in context, mm-hmm. it's one big secular display. Now, I don't know how you could get a symbol up for every religion.
Right.
But I would think,
those of us who don't believe in religion and don't want any symbol at all.
Yeah. What would our symbol be?
Yeah. Right. Well, it could be nothing. You know, if there's nothing up there, there's the secular symbol. So
that square of grass that we didn't pollute with imagery is yours.
Exactly.
But it seems to me that if you want to put something up to honor the dead that doesn't run afoul of church-state separation, that doesn't run afoul of people's independent religious beliefs, that the correct thing to do is to put up something that honors the dead. Look at, mm-hmm. you know, the Vietnam War Memorial, mm-hmm. where you have a big wall of names.
Right.
I'm not aware of any religious imagery that was specifically put up there by the government in putting this display on. I could be wrong. It may be that there are symbols of different religions carved into it. I don't object too much to that. And if people who visit there want to leave, you know, crosses and other things to honor their dead, I mean, that's an action on their part that we'd have to support.
Yeah, for an individual.
But when you're talking about a state action to memorialize, you know, our fallen brethren, I think that the only practical solution is to have no religious imagery at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Madison and others had said. You know, there's that brilliant quote from Madison that I'll butcher, where he said that the only appropriate use or interaction between the government and religion is to settle disputes of a secular nature between religions.
Hmm.
He wouldn't even want to, you know, some of the funding that we're currently doing.
Well, another good example is think back to last year in Washington State, the Christmas displays.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
That turned into a real circus.
Yes.
And I think Washington State learned their lesson and said, no, we're not doing any of that this year. And I think that's the only rational approach to take. Just leave state out of the religious imagery department altogether.
Right. You want to put your nativity scene up? Put it up in front of your church.
There's, or your house.
No argument there. Yeah.
Right. This reminds me of a story that you said, Matt, I think on one of the Atheist Experience episodes about, I think it was a school who the students had some, I don't know if it was some Wiccan or some sort of New Age article sent home, and parents got really upset about it. Before, they were just arguing for, I don't know, it was, I can't remember the story exactly, but it was some sort of activity in school that was a church sponsored that the parents kind of made a big hooey about, and then they started sending some other things from other religions, and then, of course, the parents just had another big stink about that because they want to protect it when it's their religion, but...
Right.
You know, when it's other religions that they don't agree with, then we'll wait a second.
Yeah, it's religious freedom for everybody who agrees with me.
Right.
Right.
Which, by the way, I'm not in favor of, even though it would benefit me, to take that position. And I don't know anybody who is. I haven't met any atheists. There may be some nut job out there like, you know,
rare.
Patrick Green, who wants to sue everybody into oblivion. Of the vocal atheists, the people who are doing podcasts and blogs and active in the community, the ones that I've met and talked to, we all are pretty much of one mind on this issue, and that is that what we're advocating is absolute freedom of thought.
Mm-hmm.
You get to believe whatever crazy thing you want. You just don't get to act on it when it affects other people. You know, I'd prefer that they not believe the crazy stuff. Not just because I think that it's almost impossible to avoid the actions in some cases, but also because I'd like to live in a world surrounded by the rational people.
Be nice.
But I'm not. Yeah. I'm not. I couldn't ever advocate, you know, enforcing it in any way. Not only that, but how do you, you know, you thought crime legislation is absurd.
Yeah.
So while Dennis is grabbing another article and we're
I got nothing.
You got nothing.
Are there any questions for PZ?
We're winding down, but somebody in the chat room wanted to know if PZ had anything on his calendar for Chicago.
Which he doesn't
know. I don't. That's not that far away.
Ah. See? So the answer is no, and you need to correct that, listener. Get something on his calendar.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I'm pretty open to invitations. You just cover my travel expenses, and I'm happy to go just about anywhere. Although I am putting my foot down, and I'm not taking any new invitations for the next month and a half. I've got to get some work done. So, but spring. This in the spring. I'm wide open.
Spring cool. would be perfect time for you to come here because. Not that you need another lure to Austin, but we actually have two endangered birds that occur here, one of which nests only in Central Texas in the whole world. So you could come check out some of the biology here as well.
Yes. And it's also good because spring in Minnesota is kind of frigid and cold and goes on forever and then suddenly turns into summer. So anything to get me away from the snow would be great.
Well, we'll do what we can on that front for sure. I'm checking to see if there's any last-minute questions. We were ill-prepared for today and started late, and so I wanted to definitely thank you, PZ, again for coming on.
Oh, yeah. And well, your podcasts are always fun, no matter what. So, yeah, keep on being ill-prepared. It still works.
Awesome. Yeah, if we prepared, the show would suck. I mean, it would be like me reading one of those articles over and over again. But we'll definitely get you back on, and I'll probably contact you as soon as I can about maybe getting you down here to Austin this spring. We'll have a good time. And don't let me forget, you have to go to Esther's Follies with us. For our bat cruise in September, Austin has the largest metropolitan bat population. And every year we get a boat and go out to Town Lake and watch the 3 million or so bats go out for their nightly feeding.
Oh.
And after the show's over, there's this kind of unique experience down on 6th Street. It is musical, comedy, magic, extravaganza from a liberal hippie perspective. And I took some of the folks who came in from out of town this year. And as far as I know, they all loved it. And I go 3 or 4 times a year because it's fun.
I've never been. I need to go.
We'll go. Yeah. Yeah, we'll go.
Bats and liberal hippies, you can't go wrong.
That's Austin in a nutshell.
Yeah, cool job. One of the more common questions we end up getting in email is, you know, aren't you afraid to be doing the TV show? Not this podcast, but aren't you afraid to be doing the TV show in, you know, in Texas? Oh, you guys are so brave. No, I'm not that brave.
No,
I probably wouldn't be doing the TV show in Lubbock.
Or Texarkana.
This is the Oasis.
Yeah, this is Sanityville. Well, actually, no, it's not Sanity.
We got the state capitol here. It's not Sanity.
We just don't have a huge contingent of religious extremists who would want to do harm to individuals. We have our more than our fair share of nut jobs, religious and otherwise, but particularly in the new age woo that tends to reside in the liberal, hippie, uncritical portion of the population.
Yes, our being is... Some of our brothers and sisters need a little bit of education.
Well, yeah, and this is why I'm so concerned about the school board, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm thankful for your blog, and we'll continue to do, you know, the shows we do, because I you know, talk about debates and raising the public level debates and getting discussions out there, but my number one issue is education, because I don't, you know, you can't get anywhere if we don't fix what's wrong with education, particularly public education. And with our state board being having effect outside of Texas, we're the largest single adoption state out there. And so what happens on Texas State Board of Education affects students around the country. California is one of the few that might be partially exempt. And I know that some schools have added inserts to books that were written for Texas. So when we had a representative from Texas Freedom Network speak to us a month or so ago, specifically about the health curriculum that's coming up after the new elections. Currently in Texas, there is only one textbook that mentions the word condom, and it's in use by 1% of schools in Texas. All the other schools in Texas use health books that don't talk about condoms, that don't give students information about STDs, that don't talk about anything other than abstinence. And one of the books even suggested to teenagers that one of the best things to do to avoid these urges is to sleep more.
What?
And they evidently, she made the joke that evidently they forgot to mention that you should be sleeping alone when you sleep more.
And they left off the part about cold showers and thinking pure thoughts?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, what a deficiency right there.
All right. Man. Well, I'm going to go ahead and let Pease go. Thank you again very much.
We'll
have you back whenever you can.
Thank you.
Let's do it again.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As always, I love having him on, and it was good because Russell was out today, so it worked out well.
I read his blog every day.
Yeah. He's awesome.
And if you're not reading his blog every day, then what's wrong with you? Don't you know he's like
that's right.
Pope 2.0? You know, if you're not following lockstep with Dawkins and P.Z. Myers, there's something wrong with you. All right. We got started late, but we managed to do the full-on show. I got in the special request from my significant other, which I'm sure I'll be rewarded handsomely for doing.
So what, just given a... She just wanted you to mention that? Because
yeah.
I was... Okay, gotcha.
And then I'll forward emails to her or... I forgot to find out...
Oh, if anyone has experiences. Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
I forgot to find out if she wanted me to give out her email address or not, but I'll just forward them to her if anybody has any experiences with proselytizing at hospitals and healthcare providers.
Mm. Excellent.
I know there's some big announcement that I'm forgetting. Because I skipped over the normal announcement,
right,
so we can get
right
to PZ.
Oh, I have a question.
Go.
When is Atheist Experience going to be back in the studio, or are they already? They're not yet.
Next
right?
Sunday.
Okay, great.
Cool. Tomorrow.
Exciting.
Tomorrow we will be doing it from here
for
the last
time.
Oh wow!
And in an amusing turn, we will be doing it from my brand new furniture. So for the one individual out there who commented that I had a crappy couch, and they were right. I now have a nice dark navy blue leather love seat and chair that my parents brought up last weekend.
They complained that you had a crappy couch?
Yeah. That's right. This is...
That's so lame.
I'll tell you about it later. It's not a fan of the show.
What animal does navy blue leather come from?
Manatees. We slaughtered a dozen manatees to make these couches.
Oh, awesome. Who's the host tomorrow with you?
I don't know.
Okay.
I'm still working. Actually, this week I worked slightly less, and I have the weekend off. There's rumors that we're going to scale back on the weekends. I don't want to sit here and bitch about my job. I just do want to say that we're doing another nonprofits next Saturday.
Okay.
To get back on schedule.
Get back on schedule. Sure, sure.
I'm in.
And
I'm there.
The TV show starts live in the studio next Sunday. So for people who watch both shows, expect all kinds of problems. Expect everything to go wrong. And expect the show to be a complete disaster. And that way, when it's a huge success, you can send all your logs.
All right, the bars
I know something low. You might want to announce is, was it the last episode got messed up?
Yes. There were several people who said that the audio in the last episode of Nonprofits got choppy. There's nothing I can do about that.
It's in the original.
I checked. It's in the original. It was probably, because I'm recording on a laptop, it may have been something running in the background interfered and caused it to get choppy. By the way, you don't need to report problems with the audio over the phone today. I did some tests before the show and got it to sound as good as I could, but I realized that when we're doing that, it sometimes comes over as a little scratchy. I'll do what I can to keep fixing and making improvements.
Sounded good over the headphones.
Yeah, what we're hearing sounded good, but when I called Beth earlier, she was like, oh, you guys sound so scratchy, and so I've made 20 adjustments on the board. So,
right.
So tomorrow's Atheist Experience is going to sound like crap from all the changes I made today. But
right.
Anyway, thanks a lot, everybody, for showing up and for hanging out. We'll be back again next week. Dennis, you can conclude.
Special guest is always cool. Okay, well, according to most interpretations, the show is considered over at this point. And although it is understood that your host, Dennis Loubet, Matt Dillahunty,
yes,
and Kathleen O'Connor.
Bye.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. These claims should be viewed in the cultural context in which they were issued, as should the presentation of Listen to Reason by Brian Stieksma, with which we leave you until then.